Do you want to? Is it?
Hey, folks, this is the LifeScan Learning Lab edition of the Get Balanced podcast. And with me, your co-host, Dr. Donnie, and my good friend and co-host, Chief Todd LeDuc, and also Chief Strategy Officer of LifeScan Wellness Center. And I'm going to kick it right over to you, Todd, to take it away for this podcast.
Hey, thanks, Donnie. Great to be back and at it taping another episode. This one's going to be another great one. We've got a friend and colleague, and I'm excited about today's interview. So let's just jump right in. And I want to introduce Chief Anthony Stowers, from actually my old stomping ground up in Massachusetts. He's the fire chief of the Maynard, Massachusetts Fire Department. So, Chief, I want to welcome you to the podcast, and thanks for agreeing to come on as a guest.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Donnie, we kind of start the podcast every time just reflecting on how we've grown over the last year doing the podcast taping, and we've got hundreds of listeners. And Donnie reminds me all the time that not only are those from across the United States, we actually have an international audience as well. So maybe if we could just start by, and I see you and I must have been running in the same circles over time, because I saw you started your career in New Hampshire, if I'm not mistaken. And I ended up going to high school in Nashua and working EMS in the Merrimack Valley is how I started my career. But why don't you share with our audience, our listeners, if you would, just kind of your journey, your fire service journey, how you get into the service, where that's taken you, and how you've evolved to where you are today as the fire chief at Maynard.
Sure. So, I started my career back in 1988. My father was a firefighter, and as a little kid, I saw what it did to him. I was 12 years old when he got appointed, and I saw him kind of a change in his life. It was a change in our family's life. And, you know, I got to know people that he considered his second family, and I was really drawn to that. So I started my career in 1988. I started on a department called the East Dairy Fire Department, which actually no longer exists. It merged with the Dairy Fire Department, which was where my father worked. In 1996, I transitioned to the city of Nashua. I worked for the city of Nashua for 11 years. I made it to the rank of lieutenant. And at that time, I was offered a deputy chief's position for the town of Merrimack. And I decided to take it. It was a new opportunity. It was an opportunity to grow. It was an opportunity to use some of the training and education that I had accumulated to that point in my career. So I took that job, and I rose to the rank of assistant chief there. And then in 2012, I had the opportunity to come down to Maynard. So I put my papers in, retired from New Hampshire, and came down to Maynard. Maynard offered some challenges that, you know, I'm one of those people that likes that challenges. So it offered some challenges. And so far we've worked together down here, and we've done well. So now, go ahead.
Chief, did you say you retired from the one and then went to Maynard?
Yes.
How long was your retirement more than 1 hour the way Todd's was?
No, actually it was less than that. So it was,
he's got me beat.
Yeah. Wow, well, I accepted a job down here before I retired from New Hampshire. So I was actually still on the books in New Hampshire, using some time up when I started down here. So it was a quick transition.
That's why Donnie's still working to correct the whole work-life balance thing and first responders. what a great career. And shout out to those New Hampshire departments. I know Nashua, the chief just retired as well. And I think he did the same thing. He ended up with one day of retirement. Now he's working with public safety consulting. So, but yeah, great department, great people. They're actually a LifeScan customer, and shout out to them. What I'd like to do maybe is just talk a little bit about your time now at Maynard. Talk a little bit about the department, the members of the department, the community, to give our, again, our listeners an understanding of the Maynard, Massachusetts fire system.
Sure. So Maynard's a small community. It's essentially, it's 5 square miles. But it's actually even smaller than that, because about 25% of the land mass is federally protected land. So it's about 3.5 square miles of streets and buildings and all that. So the population is just over 11,000. So it's a fairly dense community. One of the things I like about it is it reminds me a lot of, you know, one district in the city of Nashville. So, you know, maybe the Amherst Street District or something like that. So we have a mill, we have some businesses, we have some senior living, we have residential. So it's got a good mix of everything. It's not just, you know, residential or commercial. It's got a good mix of everything. So I was kind of drawn to that to begin with. And we run a myriad of calls. We have an ambulance service here. We have an ALS intercept service, which means we run the BLS end of it. All of our firefighters are cross-trained as EMTs. If it's an advanced life support call, we have an intercept service from professional ambulance, and that works out well. But, you know, like everyone, we the majority of our calls are our EMS calls. We're doing about 65 to 68% of our calls are EMS calls. And we're still doing our fair share of fire calls, but most of it's EMS. When I got down here, you know, we had some challenges. Department needed some equipment. We were in desperate need of a fire station. And, you know, we quite frankly had some culture issues that we've worked on together. And we've had some turnover, which was helped improve some of that. But one of the things I've learned is the key to anything is to build a relationship. And that relationship is built on trust. Well, I was an outsider coming in. I'm only the fourth chief of the department that they've ever had. So, and I came in from not only another department, but another state. So, you know, there was some trepidation on their part, and it took a while to build up trust to where we could rely on each other to do the right thing, to do the right thing for the organization. So it's taken some time, but we've finally gotten there.
Yeah, that's a great overview. And I think particularly for listeners out there, you know, that may be coming into organizations from the outside, or conversely, you know, members of an organization that welcome, hopefully, a chief coming in from the outside. I think that principle that you talked about, wouldn't you say, you know, building trust, relationships, would you say that's the kind of the bedrock principle from your perspective in being successful on both sides of the equation, you know, making a functioning relationship and a team?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I think, you know, there's a lot of comparisons to the fire service and the military. Well, you have to be able to trust your leadership, whether it's your first level leadership, company officer, or the fire chief. You've got to trust that they're doing everything in their power to keep you safe, to keep the organization moving forward, to get the best equipment that they could possibly get, you know, and they're not just looking out for themselves. You know, it's most definitely it's we and not I. And I think that's extremely important for leaders to understand, and some do and some don't. And we've all worked for different people. But trust, I think, is the bedrock of everything.
You know, trust is, I always found to be such an interesting concept within the organizations, you know, because we're all human beings. And that's what I love studying, is the human behavior. Is one of the best books I ever read when I was running organizations, and then I consulted with it, was the book called Speed of Trust by Stephen M.H. Covey. It's the son of Stephen Covey, or the late Stephen Covey, that wrote Seven Habits, Highly Effective People. But that Speed of Trust would break trust down into four parts, and it just made so much sense. It was like, do you trust someone's integrity? You know, does their yes mean yes, no mean, you know, are they honest, right? Do you trust their integrity? The second one was, do you trust their intentions? You know, are they looking out for your best interest, right? The third one, capability. Do you trust their capability? And then the fourth one is, do you trust the results? You know, do they deliver results? I went to his workshop. And it is just so amazing of how we a lot of times we don't trust people, but we can't pinpoint why we don't trust. We just have that, you know, I talk about a lot of times. I have a best friend that he's an IT guy. I would trust him with my kids. I trust him with everything. But do I trust that he's going to fix that computer the day he says he's going to fix that computer? Nope.
Well, you know, it's funny, a book that I read a few years ago that really changed my focus and my approach. It's an easy read. It's called Ego is the Enemy by Ryan Holiday. I don't know if either of you have heard of it, but it really changed my outlook on things, because when you take away your ego, when you make decisions that are not based on what your ego wants, then you naturally start doing what's best for everybody. And it makes it a lot easier. And now, we're not perfect. We're human. I think somebody mentioned that earlier. So there's always that tendency to revert back to that. But I have it actually written right on my computer. Ego is the enemy. So when I try to make a decision, or I make a decision, I try to take that away from it. And for me, I think that was a turning point with my relationship with my people, is when I took the ego away from it and started just, you know, this isn't to build my resume. This isn't to make me look good in front of the chiefs or the town. It's to build the department. I think there was a noticeable difference in the way they reacted to some of the decisions that I made. So for me, that's been the key to building trust, is taking ego out of it. Because if you do that, you know, everything else is done for the right reasons.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it really transcends just even the job, right? You know, into our relationships and our, you know, values and how we treat others. So some great books. I wrote both down. Hopefully our listeners out there are grabbing those now and reading up, but all about people. And I think that's, you know, ultimately what it comes down to. And certainly, Chief, it seems like you've built that trust and that bridge coming in from the outside. And I know that's oftentimes not easy to do. So some great lessons. I want to pivot a little bit and talk about, I know you've, you know, had a strong focus on health and wellness for your employees. You know, how important that is, you know, it, just in the service that we're in and all the occupational health threats that unfortunately are inherent in what we do. You know, we're just, I don't know if we're out of it yet, but come through a global pandemic. Certainly it brought health challenges, both physically and behavioral wise, to first responders. But you really have embraced providing your members with a high level of health and wellness and safety. And one piece of that is your department has embraced LifeScan Wellness Centers for medical surveillance. And I actually tell this story because it sticks out in my mind that you actually send members, and I think you yourself have traveled down to Florida, that you believe in it so much. Can you talk a little bit about kind of your department's approach and LifeScan physicals and how that fits into the overall department and how it's been received by the troops? You know, I think, you know, we always still hear, you know, there's that trepidation of, you know, if I'm going to have a fire department physical, what happens if we find something? So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I first became aware of LifeScan through a friend of mine that I met in the executive fire officer program, Sean Oak. Sean was the chief in Albemarle, North Carolina.
He's running
a bakery, right?
He's got his bakery up and running. Absolutely. Yeah. Looks delicious.
So he introduced me to Patricia at Fire Rescue International, I think it was in Atlanta. So, you know, they offered certain parts of the physical down there as a demonstration. So, you know, I was really kind of hooked on that whole process, because it wasn't just focused. Some of them that you see they're focused on cardiac, or they're focused on, you know, body fat or just fitness level. But I felt LifeScan was more of a total package type thing. I mean, they do the ultrasounds to look at the cancer, but they also do the stress test to work on the cardio. And they also look at the overall body picture, you know, and they include things like the strength test and the body fat measurements. So I felt like LifeScan offered all of it. And all of that stuff is important to us as in the fire service. So, you know, bringing it back here was difficult. You know, it was, it's a, again, it's a trust issue. And you mentioned it a minute ago. What happens if something goes wrong? So we ended up, I drove down to Florida with one of my captains who was a member of the labor group, and we each got the physical. And I wanted to show the labor group what it was all about. So he came back here and he spoke on behalf of it. And then we tried to do it that same year, later that year, try to get LifeScan up. But we ran into an issue up here on our end with collecting blood samples, which was completely my fault. We mismanaged that whole thing. So we tried it again the following year. And again, there was some serious trepidation on the part of the labor group. You know, we outlined exactly what we were looking for as far as what would take people out of service. You know, and there was only 7 or 9 things that would take somebody out of service, and all of them are life-threatening. So we're not going to take somebody out of service. You know, if somebody had a spot on their kidneys or their liver or whatever, you know, we gave them that information they could bring to their primary care physician, but we weren't out to take them off the truck for that. So, you know, again, they took a leap of faith. And the first day, the first hour that we had physicals done, we had to take 3 people out of service for serious cardiac issues within the first hour. So true to my word, we put those people all out on injured on duty, which in other parts of the country is workman's comp. And they were paid their regular pay. Actually, they're paid minus, they didn't have to have taxes taken out for the entire time they were out, and they rehabbed. And it was successful. So all 3 of those people came back, and that went a long way with building and building on the trust that we had developed to that point, and taking away that trepidation on the part of the labor group. And it also gave everybody a good benchmark for themselves that they could go back to their primary care physician and work on things. So that, you know, the big thing there for us was a foundation. One of the reasons that we try and send new hires down to LifeScan is because we want them to have that baseline. Now, Massachusetts is, they're not unique, but, you know, they have the heart-lung bill, which means that, you know, if you go out, if you have a heart attack, or you have, you know, a respiratory problem, and in some cases cancer, it's covered. It's considered injured on duty. But in order for us to really recoup that or really take advantage of that, if something happens to someone, we've got to have the good baseline. And I think that's what was missing. And I know it was missing here, and I'm sure it's missing in other places too. So, you know, if you got that, if you have that baseline of when they started, they didn't have this issue, and 10 years in, look, they have cancer or whatever, it makes it easier for them in the long term to make sure that they're healthy and they're set up and their families are taken care of in the long run if something happens. So that's why I push for it here. And the lucky thing for us, or the good thing for us, is the labor group, after that first year, they actually saw the value in it so much that they wanted to put it in a contract, which a year previous to that would have been unheard of. So it's now in the contract. They get a physical every year, a 1583 physical every year, where, you know, they look for certain things. And so, I mean, I couldn't be happier with that.
Yeah, what a great example to talk about, you know, relationships and how you embrace the joint labor management approach, and what a, you know, you talk about building trust. Really, it sounds like you have 3 potentially averted line of duty deaths from, you know, cardiac deaths. So, you know, that's, for our listeners out there, that's you know, certainly the goal, right, is to find these lurking issues, potentially, whether it's cancer or cardiac, at the earliest stage where they're easy to take care of, and we don't have tragedy striking. So that's wonderful to hear. And I'm glad that labor and the community are able to come together and continue that by solidifying it in the collective bargaining agreement. So I want to kind of pivot again, and this is a little bit more personal. I know you shared with me and Donnie, that you had a personal health journey, and I want to see if you'd be comfortable in sharing that, and you know, it's a course that it's taken, because I think, you know, while cancer continues, and rightly so, to be a large focus in the fire service and afflicting our members, we still acknowledge that, you know, the leading cause of on duty fatalities is sudden cardiac death. And we know that for every death, there's about 17 non-fatal cardiac events. So I want to ask you to share your story. I think it's very, very timely. There's some new recommendations from the Better Heart study that Dr. Denise Smith, a dear friend, has headed up, and I was honored to be part of the project team. And it's recommending some advanced screening, and we'll talk about that. But if you would share what you've gone through of recent, and where that's taken you.
Sure. So back in December, I had cardiac bypass surgery. So I had three blockages. And it really kind of caught me off. It did catch me off guard. It wasn't really. It did catch me off guard. Earlier that year, I had my life scan physical, and that included the stress test and the blood work. You know, my blood work came back with my cholesterol being about 225. It's high, but it's not extremely high. So I felt that was under control. I exercised, you know, 4 to 6 times a week. I ate fairly healthy. Don't smoke. I haven't smoked for well over 31 years now. So, you know, I was kind of caught off guard with that. But earlier in the summer, I had taken a fall and broken a couple ribs, 4 ribs. So when I started having some chest pain over the summer, I attributed it to the ribs. Turns out it wasn't. It was a blockage. So I called my primary care physician. You know, they listened to my symptoms and said, "We want you to go to the hospital and get checked out. We think it could be a cardiac issue." Of course, being a typical male, I said, "No, it's not cardiac. I just had my physical. Everything's fine. It's good to go." So I told my wife what the primary care physician had said, and my two daughters, who are both in healthcare, and they urged me to go get checked out, Dad. And I'm like, "Fine." Finally, I gave in. I said, "I'll go to the hospital. They'll clear me. I'll go to work. I'll call you later." Well, I walked into the hospital, told them what was going on. The emergency room doctor came out. They put me on it. They gave me an EKG. He sat me down. He said, "What you're describing sounds like a blockage." He says, "You're going to be our guest for the day while we check it out." I'm like, "Fine, but I don't think it's cardiac." So they sent me for a stress test. Now, keep in mind, I had a stress test 5 months before that and had no issues. Well, this time I had a serious issue. I had chest pain, sweating, really out of breath, and I'd never experienced that before. So they said, "You have a blockage." So they didn't know exactly where. So tomorrow we're gonna send you to the cath lab, and hopefully you can get it taken care of. I'm like, "All right." Now, keep in mind, that was Monday afternoon. The cath lab was scheduled for Tuesday morning. Wednesday morning, my daughter was graduating from PA school. She's a physician's assistant now. So, you know, I went into the cath lab and I said, "Doc, just get me out of here so I can go to the graduation tomorrow." So she did the catheterization, which you're fully awake for. It's just they basically go through your wrist and they check out the arteries. So she was in there about 5 minutes and she said, "You're not going to graduation tomorrow." "Oh, you got to be kidding me." So she was great. So we finished up and she came in, she met me and my wife afterwards. And she said, "You have 3 blockages and they're all in bad locations where we can't do stents. We're going to have to actually go in and do bypass surgery." So the first question my wife asked is, "Why didn't this come up on the life scan physical? He has a physical every year." And she said, "Because where they're located, they never would have found them. The only way we found them is because we did the catheterization and went in and took a look." So, you know, I was still not in denial, but I'm like, this doesn't make sense. I mean, they don't have the same risk factors that other people have. No family history or anything like that. So, but at the end of the day, it is what it is. It doesn't really matter how you got there. It's what they do with it once they find it. So they scheduled my surgery for Wednesday. and then they had to cancel it because up at least in the Northeast, we had a resurgence of COVID, and the emergency room or the, ICU was full. So they had no beds. So they had to delay it for another day. And I felt fine. I wasn't exerting myself. I'm like, this is ridiculous. I'm taking up a spot in the hospital, but they wouldn't let me do anything. I couldn't even get out of my bed and walk. So we finally get the surgery scheduled for Thursday. And they went in there, and it was about a five-hour procedure. And they took care of the problem. And then, you know, later that night, I woke up in the ICU. The next day, I was transferred to a private room. And that night, that first night, I ended up having some complications. So they had to put a wound tube up above here to drain, you know, the wound where the wound area was. And then I still had problems. They ended up having to put a chest tube in there in the side. So I ended up staying in the hospital for 10 days, but I did not have a heart attack. There was no muscle damage. So they caught it early, which is the key. That really helped in the fact that I was otherwise healthy, certainly contributed to a quick recovery. I was home for probably 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks. And then they sent me to cardiac rehab, and I did very, very well in there because, you know, I said, look, the people across the street in the hospital are great, but I don't ever want to see them again. So I worked hard to make sure that didn't happen. But, you know, one of the things that you learn when you go through this process is, you know, you might think you're doing things correctly and, you know, you're doing things that you think are the right thing to do, but you need to build on that. And, you know, for me, it was diet. I've cut back on sugar. That was a big contributor to cholesterol. You know, and sometimes we eat things that we think are healthy. I'm eating chicken sausage. I got to be doing well, right? Well, there's a lot of things in the chicken sausage that still processed foods that aren't good for you. So I cut that out, and I worked with a dietitian to make sure that that wasn't happening. But I also revamped my exercise routine, and, you know, it wasn't just going to the gym and punching my ticket. It was actually getting something out of it, setting goals, working hard, and really trying to make progress. So all that has helped me tremendously. And I feel better now physically than I have in years. I'm still recovering from the surgery itself because it's trauma to your chest. But they expect that to go away by next month. My restrictions will be gone. So the process to me was eye-opening. I'm very, very, very fortunate that, well, first, my family pushed me to go. But second, that I didn't have any damage prior to it. Most people that are in my situation, they have an event that creates the need for the surgery. So I didn't have that. So, you know, I'm really thankful for that. But, you know, I think the best thing that we can do as fire service professionals is, you know, we have to get away from the mindset where we eat till we're sleepy, sleep till we're hungry. And we've got to get away from that and start doing a better job of taking care of ourselves. Ironically, you know, for me, I just completed my doctorate. And part of that doctorate was just doing research, like you just mentioned, that, you know, for every fatal event we have 17 non-fatal events. The average cost of rehab is about $1 million for somebody that has a heart attack on duty. And that's a lot. So ironically for me, you know, I finished up the final edits for my doctoral study while I was in a hospital bed getting treated for cardiac issues. So just a little bit of irony there, but yeah, that's my story.
Well, Chief, thank you for sharing that. I'm glad to see that you're well on the mend, and you, as you said, you're blessed that no cardiac damage, and congratulations on your doctorate. Joining Donnie in very well earned in hard work. So congratulations. I know that doesn't come easy.
Especially from a hospital bed doing edits.
Absolutely. few can say that, I'm sure. Wow. Talk about dedication.
I did have a question for you when you mentioned that you found your cholesterol, you said, was 230 or two something.
Yeah.
Like that. Were you on medication at the time?
No. So I had been on medication early in the 2000s. The doctor put me on medication. But I started having muscle pain with that. So again, I revamped my diet, and I was exercising a lot. So every year I got my blood work done, and it would be slightly above 200, but my good cholesterol was such that they didn't feel I needed to be on medication. So March of this past year, not of 21, was the first time that my primary care physician or anyone recommended you need to go back on medicine. And I said, it's fine. I can take care of it with exercise and diet. So to answer your question, no, I wasn't on medication, but I am now. But prior to that, I hadn't needed it. So the thing for me is my situation happened fairly quickly. And I don't know if I mentioned earlier, but I did suffer an injury. I fell. And the doctor said, hey, that might have contributed to it. It might have knocked some plaque loose somewhere, and it just accumulated in a bad spot. We don't know. There's no way to really prove that. So, you know, things can happen quickly. But, you know, I wasn't on medication prior to.
Yeah.
And Chief, I think, especially for our listeners out there too, you bring up, you know, the importance of lifestyle. You know, we've had Jonathan Tate, Food on the Stove founder from DC Fire, on the podcast before, and it kind of putting all the pieces together, right? The exercise component, how we're eating, modifiable, preventable risk factors, no smoking, moderating drinking. So, one of the things additionally that we've found from the NIOSH fatality reports is about 80%. Of the cardiac fatalities, I'm sure you know this from the research in fire service, have either a combination of left ventricular hypertrophy, usually caused by high blood pressure, poorly controlled. And the sad part is that's easily screened for. LifeScan's been doing it for 25 years, a cardiac echo, but also subclinical, meaning, you know, asymptomatic, subclinical coronary artery disease. So the Better Heart Project, if our listeners are out to listening, has just recently released their findings. Dr. Denise Smith has led that project and recommending not only cardiac echo for firefighters, but also the recommendation is a one-time age 40 and above baseline with a calcification scoring. So we can actually look doing a calcification scan to see if there's hardened calcification in coronary arteries. But, you know, I think, you know, you hit the nail on the head in terms of prevention. Even in your mind, you're thinking you're doing all the right things. You're exercising, we're, you know, trying to eat properly, but, you know, we don't really get taught that stuff in fire school or even in our culture. So, some great resources out there. First Responder Center of Excellence, being one of them, has a tremendous amount of resources to do a deep dive on nutrition and exercise. That if our listeners are out there, it's the First Responder Center for Excellence, and that's a spinoff of the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. So, Chief, I'm glad to see that it looks like you're almost 100% back. I know you said your restrictions are just around the corner, so I'm sure that's a relief for you and your family, I'm sure. And just very, very glad to hear. And I know our listeners can't see you, but you look great. So you certainly look like you've weathered the storm well.
Thank you.
I want to be mindful of time. So I think in closing, we've touched on quite a bit today, and I'm sure no doubt we'll look to have you back on. Donnie does his weekly podcast as well, focusing on work-life balance, and I'm sure he'll probably have an interest in having you on as well. But I want to tap into not only your fire service journey and what perhaps lessons you've taken away, but, you know, your family, father, personal. If you had to, you know, a lot of our listeners are on their own independent journey and can certainly benefit from the wisdom. And we've had some great guests like yourself that have really had esteemed and distinguished careers and have learned, you know, pearls along the way. And I want to, I know this is difficult, I'm sure you've got many, but if you had to pick one piece of wisdom that you would give to our listeners, that would help them in their journey and make them more successful? What would that be?
Well, you know, I often ask myself, what would I would change if I could go back 30 years when I started? And for me, the word humility comes to mind. So, you know, I mentioned before, ego is the enemy. Well, I think if leaders can stay humble and understand that they're in this for the long run, and whatever you do, whatever position you're in, it's all about building relationships. And you have to be humble, I think, to do that. So for me, I think the best characteristic a leader can have is humility.
Some great advice. Some great advice there. I know sometimes that's hard to do, particularly earlier in our careers. You know, when we're full of vin and vinegar and but there certainly is from a leadership perspective a lot to be said for that. I know a great mentor that taught me servant leadership, and you're here to serve, not to be served, and that always stuck with me in my mind, and I think if everyone takes that approach, it puts team values first. And some great wisdom from the chief there, who's had a long and distinguished journey in the fire service, and has really done good things in the organizations that he's had the fortune to serve in. So, Chief, thanks for sharing that. I know that's a great takeaway from today, and actually, there's been so many takeaways. So, thank you for being open and sharing your story. And your department's success doesn't happen without a lot of hard work and humility and servant leadership. So it's obvious you bring that to the table. I want to thank you again for being on and coming on, and I want to wish you continued good health, and I'll look forward to seeing next steps in your career and journey and the good work that will continue. So thank you for being who you are and doing what you do.
Well, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it, and it was nice being here. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Stay safe.